Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chi-Man-Chi, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host Sam Mazur and producer Emily. Hey, guys.
Hey, Chris. Hey.
Tonight is our guest, Dr. Brittany Green, here to discuss neuroblastoma. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us what the show is about?
I would love to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Green, a pediatric oncologist and ethicist at Seattle Children's Hospital. She cares for kids, teens, and young adults with solid tumors, and thinks a lot about how we talk with families and support them through every part of their journey. She loves being part of a collaborative teaching environment. She teaches us about how neuroblastoma presents, common treatment modalities, and why we do bilateral bone marrow biopsies.
Excellent. Time to get neural about this discussion and blast our way into the topic.
Oh, man.
All right. Hello, Dr. Green. Thank you for coming on the show. Just because we're sort of an informal group, is it okay if we go by your first name?
Please do.
Excellent.
My first name is Brittany.
Brittany. Excellent. Dr. Brittany Green. So, Brittany, can you give our audience a little bit about yourself, like sort of who you are and maybe something outside of medicine that you enjoy?
Yeah, I'm a pediatric oncologist and also a bioethicist. And right now, outside of my work life, a lot of my life is focused on having twin infants at home. I will add in that I am a very passionate, diehard Chicago-style pizza fan, and I like to spend time outside, which includes with my twins. We try to get out and get some sunshine when we can in Seattle.
Excellent. Is there good Chicago-style pizza in Seattle?
There's a couple spots that hit the mark, but I wouldn't say it's as good as Chicago.
All right. So what's your favorite in Chicago then? Are you a Uno's, a Gino's East?
Lou Malnati's for sure.
Lou Malnati's. Yeah. All right. All right. I went to undergrad in Chicago. So
Lou
Malnati's is a good choice. Good choice. Excellent.
Yeah. All right. I'm glad you could carry that, because I could not carry that part of the conversation as a Northeastern or New Englander. So, so thank you for doing that. I was going to ask, you know, we kind of often ask these same questions for all of our guests, but we get such great answers, and we, you know, have kind of put together this advice column that we get for our listeners. But in the meantime, my first question for you is, what is your favorite failure and what did you think you've learned from it?
So this is actually related to what I was just talking about. As a pediatrician, I thought that I'd be super prepared, at least medically, for the NICU. And my twin boys, who were mostly just feeding and growing, they were born at 33 weeks, spent 9 weeks there for one of them. And it was a lot more emotionally overwhelming than I expected. And while I wouldn't say it was necessarily a failure, it definitely kind of caught me off guard what my response was, and really taught me a lot about patience and thinking about how to ask for help. And really just now I think about interactions with patients and families a lot differently, like even when things are on the surface, you know, quote unquote, going well.
I don't want to ask too many, you know, personal details about this, but I am curious, is some of the things that have gone on, especially in the NICU, do you think it has to do with communication and how many patients are there, like how frequently you're able to see the team, and how, you know, how you just get short piece of information and then you're kind of by yourself for so long? Or is that unrelated? I was just curious about, because as we as medicine just see so many patients and are constantly dividing our time, you know, what it does to the patients on their end and what communication we do as a result.
Yeah, I think some of it is that. And I think I started probably at an advantage in that area, right? Knowing some of the background medical information, and really with my kids being sort of quote unquote routine NICU babies. But some of it actually was, I was really surprised by how important the communication was from everyone on the team. I was probably extremely biased thinking about all of the medical providers and what that communication would be like. But really, it was like some of the therapists, the environmental services workers, the nurses, et cetera, that really could shape your day. And so while there were a lot of patients, it was actually comforting that there were a lot of different interactions throughout the day and with communication, but it did put a lot more value on sort of what the message was from everyone on the team, not just the medical providers on rounds or during their like afternoon check-in if they did one of those.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. I don't want to get too personal in this piece because this is going out to many listeners. So, but thank you for sharing.
Yeah, no, that's lovely insight. So on a slightly related note, what is the best advice you've either received as like a learner or as faculty now? Like what is one pearl that you feel like learners should hear?
I think I'll go back to my first rotation in med school, where I was doing my first patient presentation in front of the patient and in front of the team. And I must have gone on probably for 20 minutes, 30. I have no idea how long I spoke for thinking back, and it gives me some anxiety to think about that. But the attending that I was working with afterwards, who was sort of known as a person of efficiency and maybe less warm and fuzzy, said to me that it was really important to learn how to present efficiently, but gave me this advice to not lose my instinct to see the whole person and their story, and told me that it was a strength and not something to grow out of, and to make sure not to lose that throughout my medical training. And that's really stuck with me and something that I try to share with any of the trainees or learners that I work with as well.
I love that. Thank you.
Yeah, that's one we haven't had before. That's fantastic. I mean,
yeah, I agreed.
It's so difficult. You know, we go through our day-to-day in medicine. We see so many patients, and you have to work hard to try to remember the humanity of every patient you see. And so I think that's just a fantastic way to do it. So awesome. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, of course.
All right.
Awesome.
Emily, should we jump into the first case?
We should.
We've all been there. You walk out of a patient's room and need a focused differential and management plan now. Sanford Guide, known around the world for its much-loved antimicrobial therapy guidance, has covered you with a new app for pediatric acute care. There's no need to find an empty workstation. On your phone, you can search over 500 pediatric acute care topics in seconds. What you get isn't bulk or filler. It's streamlined, clinically nuanced guidance that's continuously updated by experts from the leading children's hospitals. This isn't an encyclopedic reference to scroll endlessly, and it's not an AI-generated summary. Every topic is intentionally written in a succinct, high-yield format from the start. So the Sanford Guide to Pediatric Acute Care app gives you exactly what you need at the bedside. Clear diagnostic reasoning paired with practical, evidence-informed therapeutic guidance. Search for Sanford Guide in the app stores, and Cribsiders listeners can get 20% off the already very moderately priced yearly subscription directly from sanfordguide.com. Go to sanfordguide.com and use the code Cribsiders at checkout.
Well, our first case is from Cashlack Children's. Neuroblastoma is a previously healthy 16-month-old female who presents to her PCP with a 2-week history of intermittent malaise and poor PO intake. On exam, the patient's abdomen is mildly distended with a palpable mass in the right abdomen that crosses midline. An abdominal ultrasound is obtained and demonstrates a heterogeneous mass with internal vascularity. She's referred to Cashlack Children's Emergency Department for further workup. So if we can kind of start with the basics, can you review the symptoms of neuroblastoma since they can be rather insidious and what the common presentations might be?
Yeah, of course. And I think what you just said highlights probably what I would like to impart on everyone, that really it's quite vague when someone develops neuroblastoma for the most part. Oftentimes it really might even present or look like a standard viral illness, which I think as a pediatrician, that's super hard, right? How do you weed through what is a standard viral illness and how do you not miss something serious like a cancer or a big abdominal mass? But really, neuroblastoma presents in a lot of different ways and it sort of depends on the tumor location. Of course, the adrenal is the primary spot that we think about or the textbook case of a mass that develops. And in those cases, really early symptoms are pretty vague, like you mentioned, malaise, poor intake, sometimes severe constipation. And of course, it can cause abdominal distension, and families may even notice that, but usually it's pretty slow growing. And so oftentimes it's not till maybe a relative visits and notices that the belly looks kind of protuberant that they might bring that up. Neuroblastoma can also present as paraspinal masses or up in the thoracic region. And so you might end up seeing some other sort of key or subtle features, like having either respiratory symptoms or Horner syndrome. If it's paraspinal, it definitely could result in maybe even sudden neurologic deficits or as severe as emergent signs like spinal cord compression with acute paralysis. And so really those are, it's a broad range. Some of the other maybe textbook or things to think about are periorbital bruising. Neuroblastoma can oftentimes metastasize to the orbit. And so that's sort of a pathognomonic finding if there's periorbital bruising to think about neuroblastoma. And then also it can metastasize to the bone marrow. So things like bone pain or a child that's refusing to walk, this should definitely be on the differential.
Now, you know, in the stem, we talk about that the mass crosses the midline, and for some reason, like in my head, like that rings some bells for like when I was studying for my boards. What else is on the differential that do we need to look at for these palpable masses of the abdomen?
Yeah, that's great to bring up. I think the fact that it crosses the midline is helpful for narrowing down which type of abdominal tumor this may be. So we think about other tumors that could develop in a toddler or a young child, like hepatoblastoma. We think of, you know, that would be where the liver is, as you might expect. And then Wilms tumor is another common abdominal mass that I think the textbook question that you hear, which I have actually seen in practice several times, is the parent is giving the child a bath and notices a mass of the belly and brings the patient in. So those would be less. Hepatoblastoma could cross the midline, but would usually be more superior, obviously, and is less likely to than neuroblastoma.
So before we get a little bit too far into the symptoms and diagnosis, I actually wanted to back up a little bit and just say, what is neuroblastoma, right? You say it goes all the way from the adrenals, all the way up the entire paraspinal muscles, all the way to the top. Obviously, it's a blastoma, so something of fetal tissue. But if you wouldn't mind just describing why it could be in all those places, because like, what is neuroblastoma?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So we think about neuroblastoma as coming from the parasympathetic chain or from sort of primitive neural tissue. And that actually, it's a good point to bring up early because that explains not only where it can develop, but sort of how we think about things that we'll probably bring up later in terms of staging or what age this presents and whether it may differentiate on its own. So this is a primitive tissue that has sort of neural origin, and that's the reason that it can present anywhere in this kind of parasympathetic chain or in the adrenal gland.
Fall always feels like a reset. Between busier schedules and shorter days, finding the time to cook can be really tough. That's why I use Factor. Factor makes it easy to eat well without the stress of meal prep. Their meals are chef prepared, dietitian approved, and ready in just 2 minutes. For me, that's huge. I often don't have much time in the hospital, and Factor lets me skip the chopping, cooking, and cleanup while still eating something satisfying. I also love their vegetarian meals, especially the pastas. They're comforting, filling, honestly some of my go-tos when I need something fast but delicious. Factor also gives you more variety each week, from Mediterranean diet meals to GLP-1 friendly options and even premium seafood like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. And now you can try new bold global flavors too. No matter your routine, you'll find something that works. And with Factor, you can save time, eat well, and actually look forward to your meals, even on the busiest days. So here's the deal. Eat smart at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com for 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. Get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase.
Awesome. And then for the other parts of the common presentations, you know, we kind of talked about depending on where it is, it could provide some sort of mass effect and you would feel it in that way. So if it's in the adrenals, it's in the belly. If it's up higher, then maybe you feel lungs, you know, that type of thing. What about other types of systemic symptoms? Is this a disease process that often presents with systemic symptoms, or is this mostly localized mass effect stuff?
It's a good question. Because we are often meeting younger patients who have developed metastatic disease by the time we meet them, it can have more of these generalized or systemic symptoms like malaise or bone pain, or of course, you can have bruising or bleeding if the neuroblastoma is taking up a lot of the bone marrow and the patient isn't making their own blood cells well because there's not space for that to happen. You can also have weight loss because it could potentially impact their oral intake, or if it's a little bit more progressive by the time we see it, could have impacted their level of activity or their ability to eat by mouth.
And then, you know, along those lines, we talked about metastases a little bit. Classically, you've mentioned mets to the bone and the marrow, classically mets to the orbits. Are there any other classic metastatic places that we should know about? And then we can kind of keep going down our workup.
That's generally the common places that I would think about, especially for someone that's either a young child or a toddler. Interestingly, newborns may have this characteristic skin finding if neuroblastoma has metastasized to the skin, and that can be this like purplish rash. So that's certainly something you wouldn't want to miss. If a newborn has sort of a strange, unexplained rash like that, that's something to kind of dig into more that could be indicative of that.
Awesome.
So when we're trying to work up whether this abdominal mass is, you know, a Wilms, a neuroblastoma, a hepatoblastoma, what kind of anticipatory guidance can we give to the family about what kind of workup they may experience when they hit the ED?
Yeah, that's great. Great to think about what to sort of give them as a heads up for once they get there. So certainly imaging is going to be important to identify a little bit more about the mass. This patient already had an abdominal ultrasound. Sometimes we meet patients before they've had any imaging at all in the emergency department. But really, typically the type of imaging that we'll get, especially if there's an abdominal mass or an adrenal mass, is a CT of the abdomen and pelvis. Oftentimes, we'll sort of loop in a CT of the chest as well, just to get kind of better staging and information up front, especially if there are other big abdominal tumors on the differential that standardly may metastasize to the lungs, which will help us with that differential. We would also expect that, or you can also share with the family to expect that we would send labs when the patient arrives, so probably a CBC, LDH, uric acid. Depending on the institution, catecholamines can be sent either by urine or by blood or by serum. And really what you're looking for is elevations in VMA or HVA. That's pathognomonic or diagnostic of neuroblastic tumors as well.
Is there one that's preferred, or do they have the same amount of sensitivity?
I think it's more of sort of an institutional difference of which one is sent. I will share it. At our institution, we do serum testing. And when we receive patients from other institutions, we repeat it because I think we think that that's the way. So I don't know that it's really one versus the other, or just a preference of what you're used to. But theoretically, both of them should be sensitive for testing for this. I think that's, in terms of the workup, I guess, going back to that, that's probably the extent of what might happen in the emergency department, at least in my experience. But there's definitely other workup that's important for neuroblastoma. There's a particular scan that's called an MIBG scan, which helps us as oncologists with the staging. And this is similar to a PET scan where there's a radiolabeled agent that's injected into the patient that then will pick up wherever that area glows in the patient's body. And MIBG, that nucleotide is picked up by neuroblastoma. So it helps us to find any metastatic sites. And we would expect that the primary tumor lights up as well. And then because we think about where this tumor metastasizes to, we also get bilateral bone marrow aspirates and biopsies. Which this may be getting too much into the weeds, but interestingly, marrow mets in in neuroblastoma are more patchy than in diseases like leukemia. And so that's why we have to check both sides to make sure that we're not missing that there's disease in some areas and not others. And then, of course, eventually a biopsy of the tumor is going to be needed in order to look at the both the histology for the final diagnosis. But nowadays, molecular markers are super important in terms of staging and directing management and treatment.
Can I ask about like the timing you might see of some of this testing and the urgency? Obviously, this patient got sent to the ED because, you know, they were, you know, there was some malaise, not feeling well. And it sounds like for a lot of patients who have this diagnosis, they present sort of fairly late in the game. So they may have a lot of metabolic disturbances and might need obviously other management. But in terms of the actual other diagnostics, obviously you could pull a lot of those initial labs in the MERS department. But say a patient's found earlier on instead of later, like, do they have, is this the type of patient which would, once you start down this road where you think they have neuroblastoma, that they should be admitted so they can get the bevy of workup and just get that done? Or if they're, you know, non-septic and otherwise doing okay, they can continue to proceed with a lot of this testing, especially imaging as an outpatient?
Yeah, it's a good question that I wonder if it is institution specific, what happens with that. But in my experience and thinking about patients that I've cared for with neuroblastoma, it does, the workup does often happen inpatient. And I think a lot of it is in order to sort of expedite that workup and make it so that we can get started with treatment as soon as possible. And that's not 100% of the time. And there, you bring up a good point that there are certainly patients who present even with incidental findings of neuroblastoma, they got into, or other neuroblastic tumors that are sort of on that on that spectrum or range, that definitely would, we could schedule some of this imaging outpatient and they can get the workup non-urgently.
And, you know, you kind of mentioned when you were talking about some of the more advanced testing, the nuclear medicine scan, as well as the bilateral bone marrow biopsies, and then, of course, the biopsy for diagnostic purposes. Are you doing those before you actually get the biopsy for diagnostic purposes? Or are we just saying we're going to diagnose this as neuroblastoma first, and then we will follow with those tests? What's kind of your order of operations? Because I'm curious, when I get this patient and I call upstairs, am I going for biopsy first, or I'm starting to order some of these other tests?
Yeah, a lot of it actually ends up not interestingly dealing with some of the logistics with scheduling and when these things can happen. I think we, when a patient presents with a large adrenal mass, bony mets, and cytopenias, the neuroblastoma is really high up there on our differential. And oftentimes we're sending HVA and VMA, and they'll typically result within a couple of days, depending on kind of the lab capability. And so if we have an elevated VMA and HVA with a clinical presentation like that, it's near diagnostic. And so we may be at the same time setting up their bone marrow aspirates and biopsies, setting up the MIBG scan, which can take some time to schedule, and coordinating getting a biopsy of the tumor. And sometimes the biopsy of the tumor is done at the same time as getting bone marrows and maybe even getting a central line placed to get prepared for treatment, depending, you know, if it's a weekend or after hours. There's always sort of all these nuances to think about.
Yeah. And that's actually helpful. That means like I could actually go ahead and diagnose neuroblastoma because I don't do procedures, but I can definitely order catecholamine testing and a CBC. I just had one final question about our ED workup, right? Because we have an abdominal mass in this case, but we don't actually know it's neuroblastoma. A lot of the tests you had mentioned were for, you know, almost rule in tests. Is there any test when you're sending that workup initially to the ED, say they don't have mets or something like that, any test you're doing that would be helpful for hepatoblastoma, anything that would be helpful for Wilms tumor, something for us to, or nephroblastoma, someone for us to know, like when we're sending a broad workup, what's our, you know, what are we sending for the differential diagnosis? Because if VMA is negative and this is positive, or if the other test is negative, for example, so like what am I actually sending across the board when I'm doing this workup?
Yeah, that's really important. So I would definitely, if it's not totally clear from the imaging where the mass arises from, I'd consider sending an AFP and maybe even a beta HCG, thinking about germ cell tumors, depending on the age of the patient as well. And then if we are not totally clear, if this is a renal mass or an adrenal mass, and we're thinking about Wilms tumor, I would be thinking about what the patient's blood pressure is. I would probably also be getting a UA to look to see if there's any microscopic hematuria. I'd be asking the family about urinary history and symptoms. And I think that's probably the where I would at least begin in terms of the initial workup without a clear answer that this is neuroblastoma from the beginning.
Awesome. Thanks.
That was really helpful. So for the rest of the episode, we're going to focus on older patients, but briefly, can you touch on those patients less than 12 months of age and the possibility of spontaneous regression?
Yeah, I think neuroblastoma is maybe one of the most wild cancers that we think about because it can be as quote unquote benign as a, like you said, a tumor that can have spontaneous regression all the way up to tumors where we're using maybe some of our most intensive treatments to take care of these patients. And so some infants, which oftentimes the way that we meet these infants is because on a prenatal ultrasound, which is really high quality nowadays, we can see that there is an adrenal mass in the fetus, prompting more evaluations once the baby is born. When we meet infants, we kind of share with families that this is typically sort of a unique biology of neuroblastoma that we expect an infant to have, especially if there are sort of not molecular markers that are present, if this is sort of an incidentally found tumor and the child is otherwise clinically well, we can actually just observe with monitoring labs, so monitoring the VMA and HVA and monitoring an ultrasound over time. And sometimes we don't even have to do a biopsy. We don't have to do surgery to remove the tumor. And that's wonderful. Other times, if the tumor grows by a certain amount, we may actually end up recommending resection and work with our colleagues to do that. But it's pretty neat that it's a rare situation that we have cancer where we can sort of just watch and wait. And so it's nice when we get to share that news with families.
We're sort of talking about for especially these patients where you find these neuroblastomas in infants less than 12 months of age. Can you talk a little bit more about like the age distribution of presentation for neuroblastoma?
Yeah, so typically for neuroblastoma, we think about toddler-aged patients presenting with this, but there's a pretty broad curve of how this presents. There's this group that's less than 12 months that we think of typically as having maybe less aggressive biology in their neuroblastoma. Then there's the group where maybe a more standard patient that we might think about is a patient who's just around 18 months of age, up to maybe 3 or so. And then we think about actually adolescents and young adults. We sometimes see neuroblastoma, which is very rare, but certainly possible. And the biology in those tumors is also, we think about it a little bit differently. And oftentimes those tumors are slower growing, but with that can be a little bit less responsive to treatment. So thinking of the biology and when it presents and when we meet those patients is sort of important for thinking about how we're planning to treat as well.
So it's definitely, multiple peaks, bimodal, multimodal for presentation. So I guess we still have to keep that on a differential for any of our patients that we see at whatever their age and we find abdominal mass, it sounds like.
Exactly. I would have it highest on your list for those patients who are toddlers or in that sort of younger age group, preschool age group.
So, Cribsiders listeners, let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day life as a hospitalist, FIGS. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in FIGS scrubs, and I get it, I wear them too. So, new year, new you, or at least new uniform. If you're in healthcare, it's the perfect time to upgrade your scrubs to FIGS. They're lightweight, durable, super functional, and ridiculously soft. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids, and kids come with messes, I love that FIGS are antimicrobial, can withstand wash after wash, and come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine over 50 times, and they still look brand new. So, with new limited edition colors and styles, FIGS is putting the fresh in uniform refresh. Scrubs, outerwear, footwear, accessories, and more, you'll be looking sharp, feeling good, and ready to take on anything. 2026 is here, so let's do this. And Cribsiders listeners, you can take 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code F-I-G-S-R-X. SRX.
All right, Emily, let's go back to our case.
All right. So if we go back to Nora's case, she's admitted to Cashlock Children's for further workup. Abdominal pelvic imaging demonstrates a right side of the adrenal mass with surrounding nodal calcification and a concern for liver metastases. The mass biopsy confirms neuroblastoma, and Nora is diagnosed as having intermediate risk neuroblastoma. So now that we have the diagnosis, Nora is intermediate risk, but like you mentioned, a lot of patients are diagnosed as high risk. Can you give a high-level overview about the kind of treatments that neuroblastoma may get?
Yeah. So for intermediate risk disease, we think about both chemotherapy and surgery. And usually the number of cycles of chemotherapy is sort of dependent on the response and a little bit about what we find out about the tumor. High-risk neuroblastoma, or patients with high-risk neuroblastoma, get, as I mentioned earlier, very intensive therapy. So we start with induction chemotherapy. Then we do typically a pretty large surgical resection of the primary mass. Sometimes it can be a quite challenging surgical resection for our colleagues because oftentimes these tumors are sort of wrapped around the vasculature that's in the abdomen. So it is a very... it can be a tricky surgery. Then we also do high-dose chemotherapy with autologous stem cell transplant. And actually, the standard of care for most patients with high-risk neuroblastoma is to get 2 auto transplants. And then follow that by radiation therapy and follow that by immunotherapy. So really, it's like over a year and a half of treatment for these young people with this diagnosis. So it's a super long journey. And really, with that, thinking about what the impacts of all these really intensive treatments are really go into how we talk about it with families up front.
I actually, because before we get into talking about what each of these treatments kind of entail, or at least your conversation with them, we kind of touched on intermediate, high risk, low risk. You talked about a lot of complicated things going into risk assessments. You don't need the actual classification piece. I imagine an oncologist would make that decision. But I am curious, big picture, what's in the biology between low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk?
Yeah, and by what's in the biology, do you mean like what things go into it? Like where the tumor is?
Is it location-based or is it the type of tumor? Is it the cytogenetics? Is it like what goes into making this a high-risk thing? Is it like, oh, because I know neuroblastoma is not like solid tumors that have, okay, if it mets, it's automatically our final stage of stage 4, you know, versus, you know, so that just that the big overarching concept so we can have a good understanding about being worried if this, you know, if any of our patients get diagnosed and it just says neuroblastoma, are they like, is this good? Is this bad? Am I high risk? Am I medium risk? Am I low risk? You know, those type of thoughts.
Yeah. So as we were sort of alluding to before, the age of the patient is really important for neuroblastoma, and that goes into our risk classification. And then it does matter where it's metastasized to. So interestingly, for neuroblastoma, it is not as problematic if it's just loco-regional metastatic disease to lymph nodes. But it's a pretty nuanced and complicated system that, like you said, it probably isn't worth getting into the details of. But then we also have continued to learn a lot more about some of the molecular findings in neuroblastoma that can really impact both our understanding of treatment and potentially even some of the treatments that may be available. There's some molecularly targeted treatments that can sort of be added into therapy should those findings be present. But I think as a whole, the age is probably that first sort of dividing marker of how we as oncologists would think about a presentation of neuroblastoma and maybe how what the likelihood is that they'll fit into each of these categories.
And so you were saying intermediate risk, surgical resection, chemotherapy, high risk, complicated surgical resection, it's not going to get everything, bone marrow transplant times 2, chemotherapy, radiation, and immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. What about low risk? Does low risk have any treatment or is there a small nuance that we should know about?
Low risk is either observation or surveillance are the terms that we would use and or surgical resection, okay. But not needing to give chemotherapy for that.
Awesome. Yeah, and I think from a chemotherapy standpoint, we don't need to know exactly what types of chemotherapy are involved, although I imagine we do want to talk a little bit about survivorship in a second, about the things that we should know afterwards. But before we get into that, maybe I'll ask the big picture question. Can you talk a little bit about long-term outcomes for these patients with neuroblastoma?
Yeah, so as you can imagine from the names of these categories or risks, high risk is certainly the hardest one to treat. And there's been advances in it, but it, unfortunately, we're still not where we would like to be. I think most folks, the number that's out there is probably on average around 50% of patients with high risk neuroblastoma will survive at 5 years or have the 5 year overall survival is 50%. Although I think many folks that you speak with now would actually maybe quote a slightly higher number than that, depending on now that we can give sort of more precise information about some of the nuances of the molecular findings. So maybe up to 60 to 65% of patients. Intermediate risk is higher. We're probably somewhere around, that's hard because it really depends on the patient age and some other factors, but somewhere probably around 80%. For low risk, the survival is very high. And really the overall survival is like near, it's definitely greater than 90%, but near 100%. And really is the event-free survival, which the difference of that is when we go through a period of surveillance or go through a period of treatment, does the patient have a relapse or experience a relapse of their disease? And what's important to note there is that we've found that for low-risk patients, it's safe to monitor or it's safe to do surgery only because even in that very rare situation where the tumor comes back, we have treatments that are able to get rid of that tumor and be able to cure it. So that's what that kind of differential between event-free survival and overall survival says to us.
Oh, what can you explain a little bit like what you consider, how long is continued surveillance? And like, at what point would you consider cure? Is it 10 years, 5 years? Like I don't really understand some of the lingo sometimes that oncologists use. So.
We usually sort of plan our surveillance around when the likelihood of relapse is. So definitely for the first year and a half, we are monitoring more closely. And then we start to space that out. Usually I think most folks would monitor through around 3 to 5 years following the end of therapy. And depending on the institution and where patients are at, that may transition care to some of the survivorship specialists or the long-term follow-up groups to kind of continue watching. Interestingly, for that group of patients, and this is a little bit more nuanced, but for that group of patients I mentioned, the adolescents and young adults, they may have more of, like I mentioned, a slow-growing tumor, but they may be more likely to have a tumor that actually comes back even longer or even farther out from the end of their therapy just because of some of the biology of their tumor.
Can you clarify what you mean by a survivorship specialist or a long-term group? Would that be also another oncologist who then is, you know, good at just these long-term follow-up, or is that someone else? Is that a general pediatrician who has a niche in following up some of these patients with previous cancers?
Yeah, I think at most institutions, it's someone who's an oncologist who's chosen to specialize in this. And the structure of care can really differ from one place to another, but oftentimes the model of care is something like providing recommendations for the primary care provider of how to sort of look out for some of the potential long-term side effects that we may expect from that patient's treatment. Or it may be the model of care that once a year, this patient goes and gets sort of all of their monitoring or screening for the long-term side effects with that subspecialist. Typically, I think it is an oncologist, but because there's a need for better long-term follow-up care, and that's definitely something that we're trying to work on improving. I do think that there are some general pediatricians or general internists who are interested in this area and who may be someone that folks who have been treated for cancer may go see afterwards. But typically, I would think that it's a subspecialty oncologist.
And just for the close monitoring between, you know, we'll say years 1 through 5, is that with catecholamines or is that with repeat abdominal imaging for most patients?
Usually it's both. And so we'll send labs and then also do screening imaging as well.
And then I had one other question about the kind of the survivorship or at least the long-term outcomes. We talked about this being a very insidious disease process that's kind of hard to get at until something extra happens, right? Mets to the bone marrow, it, you know, mets to the orbit, something like along those lines. This is kind of a lead time bias question. So similarly to the, you know, to the risk piece, if the cancer has metastasized, does that put you in a higher risk category or is it unrelated? And so it doesn't really matter when we find it. And if it's okay that we find it because it's a lot more metastatic, then that's okay versus really should we be trying to find it as soon as we have the inkling of any sort of abdominal mass?
Yeah, it's a great question. The teaching for neuroblastoma really is that biology dictates disease. And regardless of when we identify that disease, theoretically, the response to treatment should be the same. Certainly, if it's extremely late in the game and there are things like fractures in the bone that have developed, pathologic fractures because of bone metastases, or of course, in the rare circumstance that there's spinal cord compression, there can be other sequelae of missing the diagnosis earlier. But really, different from other cancers, and especially other cancers that develop typically in adults, we don't think, oh, because this is already metastasized, now we missed the window to treat and cure this disease. And that's something that I actually often share in the initial diagnosis disclosure with families, because that's what many families are asking. Did we miss something and should we have brought our child in sooner? And it's nice in pediatric oncology that for the most part, we can share that, you know, you brought your child in at sort of a standard time and that that won't impact their outcome.
So if, for example, if I was to ask, is there any reason to get urine catecholamines to just screen for neuroblastoma for all kids who are toddlers? It sounds like the answer is probably not, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah, exactly. We wouldn't recommend that. And really doing sort of mass or broad scale screening in healthy infants hasn't improved outcomes and actually potentially could cause some harm through overdiagnosis for infants that wouldn't otherwise need treatment or toddlers that wouldn't otherwise need treatment.
All right, moving on a little bit from survivorship, I wanted to touch really quickly on the caveat that this is a rare but can't miss presentation. But can you talk a little bit about opsoclonus myoclonus syndrome as the presenting symptom of neuroblastoma?
Yeah, so like you said, it's a rare paraneoplastic syndrome. It consists of, as the name indicates, chaotic eye movements and ataxia, and sometimes some behavioral changes or just sort of extreme fussiness or abnormal mental status. And about half of the kids who have this presentation will end up having neuroblastoma. Often it's actually lower risk disease, so like a localized small tumor somewhere. And really with that, oftentimes this OMS is actually more disabling or more challenging than the tumor itself. The treatment, while sometimes the treatment needs to be focused on the tumor, there are also treatments for OMS itself, which is really focused on immunotherapy, things like steroids or IVIG or rituximab. And so we actually partner with immunologists typically to help think about how we can manage these symptoms for this patient who may actually continue to develop or continue to have these symptoms over time, even if they no longer have neuroblastoma, which is really challenging and disabling for families.
Are there any other paraneoplastic syndromes that really are associated with neuroblastoma?
There are some severe diarrheas that can happen. And that this is like very rare, something that I think I've seen it one time so far. But basically, if you are in a place where you're taking care of a patient that has severe diarrhea and you've done your standard workup, maybe have this extra low down, but on your list of things to think about.
Opsoclonus, myoclonus, right? It's something that we hear all the time, but rarely see. We'll see what we can do in the show notes as far as putting either a link to either a video or a step-by-step or something that we can show that is available to the public, of course, so we can see what this looks like. Because I feel like I've heard of it, but I have never seen it personally.
Yeah, and I think that's a great idea. And it really, there's sort of a spectrum. I was surprised as I, I'd learned about this in med school. And then as I went through training and then became an attending, I've seen several patients with this. And there's a real spectrum. And it can be pretty subtle or pretty severe and obvious. And I think having just that in your mind of if there's these weird symptoms that are coming up, thinking about this, that's a really good, important, not miss thing that you can intervene on.
And I was just thinking just along those lines from, if you have opsoclonus myoclonus syndrome, I imagine you will also have positive urine catecholamines. So I could feel pretty good using that as an easier test, depending on your institution, to kind of check out where we are. If I feel like, ooh, that's kind of on the spectrum-y of this disease process. Does that seem like a fair statement, or is that totally?
Yeah, I think that it's very fair in that circumstance to use that as a screening tool. And if you're noticing these symptoms, I'd also probably, if you have access to a peds neurologist, have them help you think about it. And that's oftentimes how, as oncologists, we end up meeting these patients. Not always, but there may be a referral to neurology first, and they loop us in.
Well, Brittany, thank you so much for answering all these questions about detection and treatment of neuroblastoma. As we start to wrap up the episode, I sort of want to dig into some things sort of I think would be important for us as physicians, as providers, as we care for these patients, to sort of have a better understanding of, you know, what's the data out there in terms of like racial and socioeconomic disparities that exist around like detection and treatment of neuroblastoma.
Yeah, so unfortunately, like a lot of pediatric cancers, we are certainly seeing disparities in outcomes that unfortunately have not really been improving over time. So there are some studies that show that Black and Hispanic children have worse survival than white children, even when they're receiving the same therapies. And likewise, there's some really compelling data in neuroblastoma specifically about the impact of socioeconomic disparities and how that impacts disparities in their inpatients' outcomes. And certainly there are questions around timing of diagnosis or access to treatment or ability to adhere to the prescribed therapies. But I think neuroblastoma is especially interesting because a lot of the management and treatment of neuroblastoma actually takes place inpatient, and patients are receiving therapies in the hospital. And so we know when they're getting therapies and when they're not getting therapies. And even still, among this group of patients, that's sort of a quote unquote controlled group where we can see this, there's still disparities among patients from lower socioeconomic backgrounds and from Black and Hispanic backgrounds. So Kiribona has really sort of incredible and compelling work on this. She's in Boston, so that I'd recommend folks look into some of the studies that she's published. So I think what that highlights, obviously, is that there's clearly systemic issues at play here, not just this sort of barriers to care or access to care, and including systemic racism that is important to note here. So hopefully there's some folks doing some pretty cool work thinking about how we can start to overcome some of those barriers and think about some interventions rather than solely describing these disparities, because I think we're at a place where we know that these exist and we need to start thinking about how we can make this better for all kids with cancer.
Excellent. Thank you so much for answering the question. And maybe we'll make sure that we provide those citations for other people who are sort of interested in reading more about that in our show notes. Again, thank you so much for spending so much time with us today. I definitely learned a whole bunch. There was more that I learned today than I have ever forgot, I should say, about the subject. So I really appreciate it. So coming back to the end, could you, give us some main take-home points for our listeners before we sign off?
Yeah. So I think probably for the general pediatric provider, keep neuroblastoma on your radar. Definitely for unexplained constitutional symptoms or, of course, for abdominal masses. It is a rare diagnosis, but often we meet patients that are coming in whose family have brought them back to care. So if a family's bringing a patient back several times, have this on your list of possibilities. And then really the this is a wide spectrum of diagnoses, so understanding that the risk stratification will really impact a patient and family's experience and sort of their long-term outcome. Late effects are significant for some of the treatments. And then I don't know that this is unique to neuroblastoma, but I think centering the family's values and their experience in a complex diagnosis is really important. So I appreciate sort of even that question about how to prep a family for going to the ED, thinking about that full spectrum of care. Because when I talk with patients later on in their therapy, oftentimes they cite back to what they remember from that day. And many times it's not what we said as the oncologist, it's what the pediatrician shared with them or the phone call they got or what they heard about in the emergency department. So all that's really important.
Fantastic. Take home points more than just neuroblastoma, but just how to practice medicine in general and being holistic and taking care of the patient. So fantastic.
And yeah, and I wanted to ask if you had anything to put in as far as we sort of got that with our last question, but as an ethicist, you know, is there anything that we should know from that angle that we didn't really ask you?
I don't think that there's anything that's unique to ethics, right? I think ethics is we often think about tricky or hard situations and how we can better communicate. And so that's obviously relevant here when there's a complex diagnosis or a family that will have to be sort of in the medical system for a really long period of time. And maybe one thing to highlight is that obviously families come to care in all these different circumstances and life circumstances. And we, I think, often expect that people drop everything in order to focus on their child's illness and treatment. And sometimes that's not practical for families. And so sort of having that mindset of we meet families at their worst moment. And it's, I think, our job to work with families for how we can best care for their child. And that's definitely relevant in neuroblastoma, but more broadly in medicine.
Fantastic. Sam, we don't have an episode on medical ethics, I don't believe. We'll have Dr. Green back and we'll have to do medical ethics. So I think this is a super important part that, you know, I was just on service last week too, and we had to use medical ethics. And I think it's like this sort of black box for some people. It's like, you get to a point, it's like, I don't know what to do. And it's like, call medical ethics, they'll figure it out. But then like, I think there's so much more to it. And, you know, I can remember some medical ethics things from that I learned, you know, back in medical school and, you know, on service, but I think we should do a whole episode.
A lot of the practical stuff for peds, obviously I'm biased, but I think is really interesting of like, so sort of similar to like practicing primary palliative care, like you are practicing primary ethics in like your everyday work. And some of those like skills or frameworks can be really helpful, especially for trainees to learn before it reaches that stage where you're like, ah, this is like a terrible situation. Let's call ethics and see what they have to say.
Excellent. Well, you guys heard it here. She's agreed to come back to do a medical ethics episode. I think our listeners will love this episode. I learned a lot. Everyone learned a lot. So thank you so much for coming on the episode.
Yeah, thank you guys for inviting me. It's fun.
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website, thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for this episode, Emily Wells, and our wonderful social media team on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram, which is mostly Denise Cruz. And I've been Sam Mazur.
And I'm Emily Wells.
And this has been Chris the Chew Manchu. Thank you, and good night. And for those who've made it to the end, here's another decent poem written by AI. It's called Hidden in the Shadows. In belly small, a mass may grow where neurocrest cells lost their way. From adrenal glands to spine below, neuroblastoma starts its stay. Some fade away without a fight. In infants young, they disappear. But others spread all their might to bone and liver far and near. With chemo strong and surgery's art, we battle what we cannot see. Each staging tells us where to start. this childhood cancer's mystery. From raccoon eyes to dancing feet, OMS brings its strange display. Through treatment's help and paths not sweet, but hope still lights the hardest way. Hardest day? Yeah, it wasn't very good this time, but you guys made it all the way to the end. Enjoy.